headlines, a Canadian Indigenous leader calls on Pope Francis to apologize for the abuse of Aboriginal children at church-run schools in the country. The U.S. military takes responsibility for killing 23 civilians around the world in 2020. Watchdog groups say the number is far lower than the reality on the ground. And a Palestinian youth dies of his wounds sustained in the Israeli onslaught on the Gaza Strip last month. Hello and welcome, everybody. A Canadian Indigenous leader has asked for a papal apology for the abuse at the country's Catholic-run former residential schools for Indigenous children.
For the Roman Catholic Church to continue not to apologize, I think will be crime. They have to apologize. I'm talking about the Pope now.
Joseph described the residential school system operating in the country for about a century as a destructive tool to oppress the native people and control their lives. His appeal comes as Canada's Indigenous Services Minister, Mark Miller, has already condemned as shameful the lack of a formal apology from the Pope over the issue. Last week, a mass grave containing remains of 2015 children was found at a former residential school in the province of British Columbia.
Canada has touted itself as the first country in the world to adopt a multiculturalism policy. The North American country has also depicted itself as an outspoken critic of racism and a leading advocate of human rights in the international arena. However, mounting evidence on racism and discrimination against minorities, in particular Aboriginal people, proves the contrary. Last week, the remains of more than 200 children, some as young as 3 years old, were found at the site of a former residential school for Indigenous children in the province of British Columbia. The Kamloops School operated between 1890 and 1969 when the federal government took over operations from the Catholic Church and turned it into a day school until it was closed in 1978. Prime Minister Justin Trudeau said the discovery was a painful reminder of a shameful chapter of Canada's history. Indigenous groups also demanded a nationwide search for mass graves at former residential school sites. Vigils were also held to commemorate the victims.
It's really a tragedy for having those priests and those nuns running those schools, raping and killing and murdering and abusing those Indigenous children. And it really takes effect into all the younger generation, that intergenerational trauma.
When I heard about the 250 children who, you know, were discovered, their remains were discovered in a residential school mass graveyard, my heart was absolutely broken. I've been sort of in a grieving mode since.
Between the 1870s and 1990s, more than 150,000 Indigenous children were forced to attend these schools, which were run by churches and aimed to forcibly assimilate Indigenous children into white Canadian society. The children were separated from their families and barred from speaking Indigenous languages, and many experienced physical, psychological, and sexual abuse, among other forms of mistreatment. More than 4,000 Indigenous children are known to have died at residential schools, but efforts continue to try to find others who never returned home. In 2015, the Truth and Reconciliation Commission of Canada concluded that the country committed cultural genocide with its decades-long residential school system. Such a system is just the tip of the iceberg, since reports suggest thousands of Indigenous women and girls have also been murdered or gone missing in Canada in the last 30 years. Irrespective of decades of structural and systematic discrimination against Indigenous people, which have been denounced by prominent rights groups, Canada also grapples with some other serious human rights issues, including persistent exports of military equipment to countries with a record human rights violations. However, Canada has time and again blamed countries such as Iran, China, and Venezuela for violating human rights. For now, the discovery of bodies at the former boarding school has once again turned the spotlight on Canada's claim about being a human rights advocate.
The U.S. military says nearly 24 civilians were killed in its operations in foreign war zones last year. According to the Defense Department, 23 civilians lost their lives and nearly 10 were wounded in separate operations in Iraq, Afghanistan, Somalia, Yemen, and Nigeria in 2020. In its report, the Pentagon confirmed that 20 civilians were killed in Afghanistan alone. The report also acknowledged that the families of the victims were not compensated by the Pentagon. However, the Pentagon tally on civilian killings is much lower than those provided by NGOs. Some NGOs put civilian casualties in U.S. foreign wars last year at around 100 and above. They blast the U.S. military's investigations and acknowledgement of civilian deaths as, quote, woefully inadequate. They also slammed the Pentagon for failing to pay damages to impacted civilians and families. Author and researcher Greg Simon says the Pentagon doesn't tell the truth about civilian casualties in U.S. foreign wars.
Those numbers are too low given the sheer weight of different military operations they're conducting around the world. They have also been notorious in the past for hiding the numbers of civilians killed. They were saying that Taliban's suspects were killed rather than civilians were killed. We can also see in Syria, where they've been killing civilians in airstrikes, they've been recategorizing them or not reporting them. So these figures are not believable at all. NGOs are right. There is also a very good source called The Cost of War, which is run by Brown University, which keeps track of these kinds of figures. Accountability, I do not believe there will be, because they will have internal inquiries which will rule that these were within the rules of engagement, etc., etc. I mean, this is what they do. They whitewash their own, and they'll be exonerated by a very expedient semi-legal process.
A shooting incident in the U.S. state of Delaware has left three police officers injured. The officers were responding to a call for service in the city of Wilmington. When the gunman opened fire at them, all three officers have been taken to hospital. The assailant has reportedly barricaded himself inside an apartment building. According to local media reports, a large number of police officers have surrounded the building. The Wilmington Police Department says the incident is under investigation. There is no report on the identity of the shooter yet. And one more Palestinian succumbs to injuries he sustained during Israel's last month aggression on the Gaza Strip, according to the Palestinian media. The victim is a young man named Yahya Bassem al-Ajla. His death brings to nearly 260 the number of Gazans who lost their lives in days of Israeli airstrikes and shelling. At least 66 of those killed were children. According to Gaza's health ministry, over 1,900 people were also injured before a ceasefire took effect on May the 21st. The 11-day onslaught also left much of Gaza's critical infrastructure in shambles. Many civilian buildings were either badly damaged or completely leveled in Israeli bombardments. The International Criminal Court, ICC, is in pursuit of investigating Israeli violations in the occupied Palestinian territories. This move was not only rejected by Israel, but also its staunch supporter, the United States. Now major European officials have come out formally signing a letter to prevent any obstruction in the ICC's pursuit of justice.
An open letter by dozens of European officials, the purpose to end unwarranted public criticism of inquiries into alleged Israeli war crimes in Palestine, such as the context of an apparent push by 50 European officials to have the ICC complete its investigation. These officials include former foreign ministers, prime ministers, and senior international officials, including two British Conservative former ministers. Roadblocks were thrown the ICC's way when the inquiry opened. The administration of former U.S. President Donald Trump sanctioned ICC court officials from pursuing the matter, something the new U.S. administration reversed.
Well, Donald Trump's position was highly criticized by various governments and many other people because it was, you know, just totally out of line. There's no question in my mind that Israel's committed human rights violations, and to exempt Israel from any sort of scrutiny is a travesty of justice.
The ICC has less to worry about, at least for now. The letter reads that the purpose of the court is well established and recognized, that accountability for serious rights violations by all sides through conflict is essential for achieving sustainable and lasting peace, The key question is, will the ICC's findings be grounds for holding anyone accountable for prosecution if guilty of war crimes and human rights violations?
Israel's afraid that there will be international warrants issued for various Israeli officials who participated in the planning and directing the attack on Gaza. Gaza is the most densely populated place on the planet. And, you know, if you look at the pictures, you know, whole families were targeted and killed. And it's grossly disproportionate in terms of what the Palestinians were doing. And Israel's attack on Palestinians in Jerusalem was the initial cause of that, which is also very troubling.
The former Danish foreign minister and former president of the UN General Assembly have said a rules-based global order is predicated upon the idea that violations of international law must be met with consequences.
The role of the ICC is important here. To be clear, it has opened a formal investigation into alleged war crimes in the Palestinian territories, many committed by the Israeli regime. Furthermore, the Hague-based court ruled that it could exercise its criminal jurisdiction over the occupied territories since the UN had accepted the Palestinians' accession to the Rome Statute in 2015.
The United States and, more importantly, Israel in this case are not members of the ICC, so they do not fall under the ICC's jurisdiction. But the ICC, as an international criminal court, can pursue the rule of law, in this case, violations of human rights in occupied Palestine. The investigation, in many cases, should be an open and shut case, since there are obvious Israeli violations that have taken place over the decades. So many violations that in a recent report, Human Rights Watch called Israel an apartheid regime. This was quite significant since for the first time ever, Human Rights Watch made the informed and evidence-based assessment that the actions of the Israeli regime with regards to its treatment of the Palestinian people has crossed the threshold qualifying it as apartheid.
I certainly concur with Human Rights Watch's assessment. Several Israeli human rights organizations, B'Tselem, have said the same thing. And if you look at the evidence, there is, it's clear that, much of the Israeli policy is punitive. In fact, current Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is quoted, saying that how he was going to punish the Palestinians and how they would, squeeze them and actually instigate problems for them so they could reach out and attack the Palestinian population.
Israel finds itself in a precarious state. With no functioning system of governance and isolation on the international stage, it is a very fragile entity. To add to Israel's worry, it's been revealed that the leaders of the resistance groups, Hamas and Hezbollah, met last year to discuss plans for the liberation of Palestine from the Israeli occupation. The recent blow dealt to Israel during the 11-day Gaza War was also part of the liberation plan. The Palestinian resistance adopted tactics used by Hezbollah during the 2006 war by setting up mock rocket launch sites to deceive the Israeli Air Force. This only means that the Israeli regime's days of violating the Palestinian rights are numbered. Forced evictions, detainment without charge, freedom of movement, home demolitions, and the killing of Palestinians are illegal actions that happen almost on a daily basis. Plus, the three Gaza wars were proof of Israel's disproportionate killing of Palestinians. The question now remains whether a judicial body can prosecute Israel and its officials into obvious cases of war crimes, regardless of the U.S. obstruction of justice in favor of Israel.
When you have, former prime ministers, ministers in governments, and high-ranking officials calling for the International Criminal Court to exercise its rights and to investigate war crimes, this is, an opportunity to review Israel's actions and, of course, hold them accountable. And there could be, warrants issued by the International Criminal Court.
The EU is Israel's biggest trading partner. Of these high-ranking EU officials who really want justice to prevail, they can economically sanction Israel, as called by the BDS movement, boycott, divestment, and sanctions, if Israel does not cooperate with the investigation. Israel faces ever-growing isolation in the international arena and risks continuing with its violations.
Elsewhere, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's opponents have secured a coalition deal, potentially putting an end to his 12-year rule. Opposition leader Yair Lapid has notified President Reuven Rivlin that he can form a power-sharing cabinet. The announcement came after the United Arab List Party joined the coalition. Lapid has spearheaded the efforts to form the coalition and managed to garner the backing of far-right politician Naftali Bennett. Under the deal, Bennett will serve as prime minister for 2 years before being replaced by Lapid for the second half of the term. Author and journalist Eric Wahlberg says the Israeli policies aren't likely to change under the new coalition cabinet.
I'm not very optimistic. Bennett, who will be the first 2 years prime minister, was adamant that no, he would not serve in a coalition with any Arabs. So that was been his stance all along. So I guess he's changed enough to get rid of Netanyahu. That seems to be the only interest because his politics, there are so many parties and they claim to be left and right, but for someone from outside, they all look the same. To me, they're all Zionists. They all believe that Israel is a state of Jews only, and that Palestinians, any Arabs, anyone else is by the Constitution is a second category person. So I don't see really much changing. In fact, some of the commentators think it will be worse.
That's a wrap for now. Bye, everybody.
We here at Arabi English Radio express our heartfelt condolences to all of our listeners. On the 32nd anniversary of the passing away of the founder of the Islamic Republic of Iran, the late Imam Khomeini, may God bless his soul.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. The program is Dialogue, and I'm your host, Mahdi. Today we want to talk about one of the great personalities in the early history of the Muslims, Imam Muhammad al-Baqir alayhi salam. Please stay tuned. Imam Muhammad al-Baqir was the direct descendant of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, and he was the fifth divinely appointed imam among the household of the Holy Prophet. He was the son of the fourth divinely appointed imam, Imam Ali ibn al-Husayn alayhi salam. Now all historians and traditionalists of Islam are unanimous that among the descendants of Imam Hassan and Imam Husayn, a maximum of religious sciences were expounded by Imam Muhammad al-Baqir. That is why the title of Al-Baqir was given to the Imam, which denotes one who splits knowledge. Imam Al-Baqir contributed greatly to the science of Quranic exegesis, scholastic theory, religious law, and Islamic jurisprudence, among many other subjects.
قال الإمام الباقر عليه السلام لا مصيبة كعدم العقل.
إمام الباقر عليه السلام stated, there is no affliction worse than a lack of intellect.
Welcome back, dear listeners. It's a blessing to have you with us on the program. You're listening to Dialogue on IRIB English Radio. We find that Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam, the fifth divinely appointed imam from the household of the Holy Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wa sallam, talked about a great many things, of course, in his dialogues and his conversations with his companions, but in one field we find that Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam urged his companions to treat people according to a certain set of Islamic social conduct, Islamic etiquettes, Islamic conduct of behavior. Of course, social rules of conduct or rules of behavior, rules of mannerisms, these social etiquettes which have been taught by Islam, of course, are for the perfection of the individual, the perfection of society, which in reality means the perfection of humanity. And so when talking about these Islamic rules of social etiquettes, we find that Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam, he talked about something with his companion Abu Hamza. Now, when talking about the door of forgiveness, Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam, speaking with his companion Abu Hamza, says to him, insist on asking Allah for forgiveness, for such insistence erases the sins. Dear friends, many times we do commit sins, either knowingly or unknowingly, or we commit sins willingly or unwillingly, voluntarily or involuntarily. Now, if we take this step by step, yes, committing the sin itself is a bad thing to do. But we must also pay attention to what we do after we commit the sin. It is even worse to commit the sin and then be staunch and be stubborn upon that sin. But if you commit a sin and you ask for forgiveness, this is relatively not as bad. And so here Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam, he tells us that we should insist, continuously seek Allah for forgiveness. We must continuously beg and plead Allah for forgiveness. And it is this kind of insistence, this kind of continuously seeking forgiveness and seeking the mercy of Allah, which truly erases the sins. And if I go a little bit on a tangent, if one does not ask Allah for forgiveness, if one does not insist Allah on having mercy upon them, then that sin, not only is it not erased, but it becomes ingrained even more deeply in the ledger of our actions. May Allah forgive every single one of us, because He is truly the most quick to forgive. Beautiful words of hope and mercy in this dialogue by Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parsetoday.com.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir. La ilaha illallah.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, the program Dialogue. I'm Attar, the producer of this program, and at this moment, I want you to listen to a shorter speech by Sheikh Abbas Mirza about Imam Muhammad al-Baqir alayhi salam.
one practical thing I was just mentioning, and I'm working on it, inshallah, you know, in one of these days. See, we tend to spend money on buying books. All of a sudden, we are very fond of having library. We go and buy a book. Unfortunately, we read it, money is also gone, and we didn't really, you know, had that sort of, you know, engagement, sort of, you know, that wow factor wasn't there. That did not, that allow me to read page after page. One of the things that is very much important with our youth is to really improve that quality of reading. You know, our children, when they go to school, they give, first thing is their reading, they start, right? They bring books every week, and we have to write in that sort of, you know, book lock to return it to school. So we have to have a book lock as well. So we have to really know that which book to buy, which read book to read first, and then which book to read after. You know, and if maybe my interest is philosophy, maybe my interest is Irfan, maybe my interest is, you know, Ahkam, for example. Every person have a different interest. And it requires someone who could really guide us to really which book to buy, which book not to buy, so that he doesn't really waste, you know, money. And then, you know, which author, you know, there are many who are Orientalists who have written in their sort of understanding, you know. So that is something that, you know, we have to come together and sort of come to an understanding that how we could really tailor. You know, that's like self-improvement. Okay, Maulana, I come here, Maulana, my interest is history. Do you have any authors you talk about? It's engagement. We got to speak to each other. You know, unless we don't ask, no, this will not. You know, the zaman, the time, the imams, the people used to go and ask. The imam would say no. Unwan al-Basri, one of the companion of the sixth imam, was a Sunni at the age of 90. He is a Sunni scholar at the age of 90 in Medina. He goes to the imam and he says, please teach me, I heard your, you know. Then the imam said, no, you go, I don't want to waste, you know, sort of, you are a scholar yourself, I don't want to risk your life because people, I'm on guard, people are watching me, right? So he said no, 2-3 times. Finally, he goes to Masjid al-Nabawi and he prayed 2 rakat prayer and said to the Prophet that, oh Prophet, open the heart of Abdullah for me so that he take me as a student. You got to push for it. You got to push for it. We have to ask over and over again. You know, not that we come here one time, we ask, oh, Maulana was busy or this was that. No, we got to engage. We got to ask for it over and over again. Right? And then finally, you know, Imam Sadiq allows him.
Thank you very much, dear friends, for listening to this episode of Dialogue. Don't forget to log on to our website at parstoday.com. Until another episode, God bless you and fi amanillah.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Dark Review.
Hello and welcome to Doc Review with me, Camelia Shambayati. In today's show, we're discussing the Netflix documentary Get Me Roger Stone, directed by Dylan Bank, Daniel DeMauro, and Morgan Penny. And joining me in the studio, we have Rich Klein, who is the vice chair of the London Film Critics Circle and chair of the Critics Circle Film Awards. And beside him is Zach Cochrane, who is an anti-racist activist with the campaign group Stand Up to Racism. Now, Get Me Roger Stone explores the life and career of the American political strategist Roger Stone, who is known as the dark mastermind behind Donald Trump's presidential campaign and is arguably responsible for putting him in the White House. Stone is a self-proclaimed dirty trickster, and this documentary exposes Stone as a man who knows no bounds when it comes to winning in politics.
The game, he has fun with it, and he's very good at it.
I'm an agent provocateur.
Political strategist.
Controversial as you can get.
An incredible capacity for treachery.
Win at all cost mentality.
When people think of Washington corruption, they think of Roger Stone.
Those who say I have no soul, those who say I have no principles, are losers. Those are bitter losers.
There's really nobody quite like Roger Stone.
The Nixon tattoo is really all you need to know about Roger.
We really pioneered negative campaign advertising.
He created the modern sleazeball lobbyist.
Washington's been worse for it ever since.
Stone's rule, it is better to be infamous than never be famous at all.
He got chased out of Washington.
He's looking to see if he can find an angle.
I was like a jockey looking for a horse. You can't win the race if you don't have a horse.
Roger saw something that nobody else saw back in the early 80s.
I suggested that Trump should explore a bid for the presidency.
He created Donald Trump as a political figure.
You're the biggest liar, loser!
What have I lied about?
Have you spoken with the WikiLeaks founder?
You're a rape tonight.
Roger, you can't just say that.
You have to be outrageous to get noticed. Yeah.
I revel in your hatred. Because if I weren't effective, you wouldn't hate me.
First of all, welcome both of you to the show. Thanks very much for coming on. And Rich, if I could start with you as our guest film critic, what's your take on Get Me, Roger Stone?
Well, the trailer really gets the tone of the film. It's done in this kind of lively, jaunty, comedic tone. But the material is just bone-chilling. It's absolutely horrifying to watch it, especially as it goes back kind of 40 years in the past, 50 years even, to him working with Nixon and Reagan and Bush and, I mean, basically all the kind of slightly shady campaigns that have gone on over the years.
It is surprisingly funny, as you say.
But it's done with this kind of sense of humor, kind of because he's so unapologetic about it. He doesn't make any bones about it. He talks about using lies and deception in all of his work and how he's very proud of doing that. And it's pretty horrifying. And also the fact that he's been working with Trump since the early 80s, which I didn't know that before, and I'd heard of him. I mean, he's been in the news, but I didn't know that he's been basically grooming Trump to be president since he met him, because he thought, oh, this is quite a quirky character that the people seem to love. Maybe he'd be a good one.
Oh,
so it just,
very,
made,
very
it just gave me the chills.
And what about you, Zach? What was your take on what Get Me Roger Stone, and had you heard of him before?
I'd never heard of Roger Stone, but absolutely very watchable program. For many people, with Trump's election, it sent shocks around the world. So to actually get some insight into how Donald Trump could have been elected, I think was very, very interesting. And to see, as Richard has said, that over four decades now, Roger Stone has not only been grooming guys like Donald Trump, but been involved in countless campaigns, but also we hear about the power of US lobbying firms, but to see one of the guys who was instrumental in this kind of sleazeball politics and how he unapologetically promoted that was very, very interesting, yeah.
I think the character you're talking about is Paul Manafort, and we're going to dissect his character a bit later on. But I must say, I think we can all agree that when Donald Trump won the presidency, it took nearly everyone by surprise, and many thought it was merely a publicity stunt. But after watching this documentary, you get a sense that there is, in fact, a method behind all the madness. And did you get that feeling as well, Rich?
Well, yeah, there's definitely this sense that, I mean, he Roger Stone claims he's just an agent provocateur. All he wants to do is shake up the system. He doesn't care about helping people, so he doesn't have any of those political values that you would think a political leader should have. He just wants to shake things up. So Trump is his perfect candidate, and you can see how he honed his skills through Nixon and Reagan and Bush. And then it all pays off for him and Trump, which means that we all pay for it. It's a pretty frightening depiction of the way that this thing unfolded over all these years. You kind of think of Trump as being a fairly recent thing because he's only emerged on the scene in the last year or two as a serious candidate. But actually, this has been in the works. So
years in the making.
Yeah.
In 1987, I suggested that Trump should explore a bid for the presidency.
This sounds like political presidential talk to me, and I know people have talked to you about whether or not you want to run. Would you ever?
Probably not, but I do get tired of seeing what's happening with this country, and if it got so bad, I would never want to rule it out totally, because I really am tired of seeing what's happening with this country.
I was like a jockey looking for a horse. You can't win the race if you don't have a horse.
I interceded with the Portsmouth, New Hampshire Chamber of Commerce to arrange a lunch. The helicopter landing was as big a news as his speech. This is kind of the first time I saw the power of Trump. The public interest in Trump was palpable. It was like electric. And he lit the place on fire.
That comment, I was a jockey looking for a horse. I mean, as despicable of a character Stone is, he is quite funny. You have to give him that at least. And Rich, Stone takes a lot of credit for putting Trump in the White House. What do you make of this?
Well, I mean, he basically created Trump as a political figure. And you hear Stone use all the words that Trump uses in his speeches. So you realize that Roger Stone has been feeding him all of these lines, all of these famous lines that we think of Trump as saying originated in Roger Stone. And the film also kind of documents the whole kind of shady political situation where Stone was part of the campaign, then dropped out of the campaign, but really didn't. That was just a public ruse, and then kind of secretly was still running things. And it's all very dodgy, but Stone is just totally unapologetic about all of it. He just admits the whole thing. He admits that it's a big ruse. It's a trick to trick the voters into voting for someone like this.
He is famous for being infamous.
Yeah.
And Zach, I want to bring you in here because you're with the Stand Up to Racism, and you've organized numerous protests against Donald Trump when he was inaugurated, and the Muslim ban. And surely you protest not just Donald Trump as an individual, but people like Roger Stone and what they stand for.
Absolutely. This is what was so useful about this film, was to get an insight into the kind of politics that were pushing Donald Trump. And I actually want to say this process, what became clear from the film, goes back to Nixon. Actually, Nixon came to power 1968. There was a book at the time by one of his advisors, Kevin Phillips, that talked about the emerging Republican majority, about channeling the voters' resentment. And that largely played out in turning the economic insecurities of white Americans into resentments towards black. It was a key strategy of Nixon. And we see this through the film when they talk about racist coding, the language is being used. Push through a number of candidates, but particularly with Donald Trump, we see the appalling election campaign. He ran the Muslim ban, the scapegoating of Mexicans, saying he would build a wall with Mexico. It's clear that Roger Stone was absolutely instrumental in encouraging Trump to go down this racist rhetoric, which I had wider ramifications.
Well, and the whole birther movement, which was Roger Stone created that whole thing about Donald Trump chasing Obama for his birth certificate was a Roger Stone create. That was his little, and that was a racist campaign that was playing into the hands of those right-wing people who have those views, who don't feel like they can express them and feel marginalized. And it's all about manipulating the people, isn't it?
So are you saying that Stone is actually as influential as he makes out to be in the world of politics?
I think he's very influential. I'm not convinced that he's actually racist. I think he's manipulating people's opinions and people's, you know, the way people feel. But he is very influential, quite clearly.
Unfortunately so. And Zach, Stone says in the documentary that Stone says that Trump is sort of this anti-establishment figure. And how is it that people perceive him to be this way, and is it accurate?
I think what we absolutely have to say, and it was brought out in the film, Trump was able to fill a vacuum. We've seen, not just in America, but a number of countries, a hollowing out of politics. The establishment has been deep dissatisfaction with them, years of neoliberal policies, and Trump was able to come in and channel that anti-establishment sentiment, not by offering people policies, redistribution of wealth, but by encouraging people to draw conclusions like scapegoating the Muslim community and migrant communities as well.
Mm-hmm. And in the documentary, Roger says that, someone who's interviewed says about Roger that he understands democracy and that democracy is appealing to the process of the majority. How accurate is this, and what do you make this claim in the film that Stone understands democracy?
Well, yeah, obviously, because he's appealing to these opinions that are unvoiced, and so he's tapping into the majority of people, the way that they feel, and which is kind of horrifying.
Mm-hmm. And does Trump represent the majority of America?
No, I think absolutely not. If you look at this is the such a worrying thing. His policies. He wants to cut corporation tax to record lows. Roll back on initiatives to tackle climate change, things that do not benefit ordinary Americans. You know, the population, we're the richest country in the world, yet a quarter of the population live in poverty, and this is a billionaire. But it's absolutely by scapegoating, deflecting blame at the establishment. It's a bogus anti-establishment. What we see very clearly from this film, Stone, his close advisor, has been involved with and Manafort, who we're going to come on to.
Actually, I'm glad you brought him up, because we're about to go to him just now. So we'll just pause there for now.
Trump asked me to get involved because my reputation, among other things in politics, is understanding of the convention process, the delegate process, and most of the major successful big conventions over the last 30 years I've been intimately involved in.
Did Roger recommend you for the job?
Roger was one of the two or three people who strongly recommended me, yes.
Is it a surprise that Paul Manafort wound up as the campaign chairman for Trump? No, of course not. That was engineered by Roger as a way to get Corey Lewandowski bounced out of the campaign. It took a couple months, but they did it. Roger has had a guiding hand in all of this. Now, Trump is hard to guide. He spits the bit out, but Roger has had as much influence on the campaign as anyone.
I think the campaign's been professionalized. Manafort's doing a phenomenal job. I think he instills confidence in the campaign that they didn't have before.
Did you give any reporters background on Lewandowski?
No.
Okay, so do you sort of...
Roger is not an official part of the campaign.
Did he bring you in?
No.
You were just talking about Paul Manafort and how much of a shady character he is. And considering his relationship with dictators, his role in lobbying, what contribution did he make to Donald Trump's campaign team?
It was clear when Roger Stone was fired, with the denies being fired, the fact Manafort suggests that Stone recommended him and was absolutely crucial in using some of those dirty tactics to get Donald Trump elected. It shows just how bogus this idea that Trump being anti-establishment is, because Manafort's been involved with countless presidents over the decades and played the same role.
And Rich, why is it that Paul Manafort, we know that he has a relationship with Roger Stone, but denies him being involved in the campaign? I mean, is this all part of the plan? What is going on here?
I just think it's part of the way that they present one thing to the public and they talk about something. I mean, all through this film, they're talking to the cameras, because the cameras are following these people all over the place. They say one thing to the camera, then it cuts to a statement like that where Paul Manafort's on television saying exactly the opposite. So they very carefully script what they say in public, and they don't care that it's not the truth. It's all about creating this image that gets them where they want to go, and they don't really care about what they have to do to get there.
And isn't that disturbing, Zach, that these politicians are lying through their teeth? Don't they think that people can see right through this and hold them to account?
They've had many decades of perfecting the strategy. It's interesting that the film starts with Roger Stone talking about as a kid in the school canteen in a mock election, where he, at the time, ironically, is back in JFK, and he tells all the other kids that Nixon will make you go to school on Saturday to win this mock election. He said he learned there the value of disinformation, and we've seen this process throughout his political career, and it is very worrying. It makes a mockery of democracy and allows them to distort politics in the interests of those at the top.
Mm. And Rich, we know that Roger Stone is dubbed as the political dirty trickster. What examples do we see in this documentary of his other stunts?
Well, I mean, all of the stuff, all of the crooked Hillary stuff, you know, just suddenly creating this huge cloud of suspicion around the Clintons, around Obama, just everything that kind of, it's just this huge cloud of misinformation that just goes around, and everybody starts to wonder, well, what's the truth? And it's very hard to pick the truth out of it, especially if you're leaning toward that angle. He talks very openly about the fact that he doesn't believe in any of the political points of the Republican Party.
Mm-hmm. He identifies as a libertarian, he says.
Yeah, and he says he doesn't believe in their any of their policies. And yet he put a Republican in the White House, and mm-hmm. he doesn't care.
And what does Stone get out of all of this?
I don't know. Yeah. Do you think he just enjoys the power of disrupting the system? He just seems like a pure disruptor, doesn't he?
Absolutely. One thing I'll say, I suppose, in terms of his libertarian leanings, I think going back to Nixon, if you look at the 1960s at the time in rising struggles, particularly the civil rights movement, Nixon was the kind of block against that. It's why he's got so much respect for Nixon. I think he's very much...
He has a big tattoo of Nixon on his back.
Yes.
And he splashes that throughout the documentary.
He does, and I think going back to the question of racism, I think it's why it becomes such a key issue. Haldeman, who was the chief of staff under Nixon, wrote in one of his diaries, Nixon said, the problem was essentially the blacks. And what he meant by that was black struggle became the nexus for other social struggles. It was leading to concessions being won, social reforms on the system. So he knew that... drawing back the civil rights struggles and the black struggles was absolutely crucial. That's why I think racism has played such a key role in some of his tactics. As you said, he might not necessarily have massive racist leanings, but he knew it was essential to push forward this kind of libertarian model that he does agree with, which is a rolling back of state intervention.
He knew he had to play that racism card in order to win votes, essentially. And I want to actually ask you more about that a bit later on.
Now the children's table is the adult table, and Alex Jones is, you know, passing the dinner rolls, and we're all conspiracy American now.
Even if Donald Trump loses, I still win, because the Stone brand has been front and center, and my brand of politics have finally come into their own. CNN, MSNBC, they're now the fringe. Alt-right communications, we are the mainstream.
Did Trump really believe that Obama was not born in the United States? Does Roger Stone really believe that Bill Clinton raped all these women? You know, it doesn't matter to them is more the point. For them, there are no boundaries. Anything goes. Anything that wins, fine.
If you read Roger's blog, The Stone Zone, or follow him on Twitter, it's like coming attractions for the attacks Donald Trump will be launching 2 weeks later.
It is Hillary who hires the heavy-handed private detectives who break into these women's homes and ransack them, who threaten their children, who kill their pets.
She's married to a man who was the worst abuser of women in the history of politics. And Hillary was an enabler, and she treated these women horribly.
Roger's, you know, relationship with Trump has been so interconnected that it's hard to define what's Roger and what's Donald. While it will be clearly a Trump presidency, I think it's influenced by a Stone philosophy.
That notion of win at any cost pretty much summarizes Stone's brand of politics. And there's so much to dissect from that clip. And Rich, if we look at the mainstream media angle, Roger Stone and Donald Trump were able to discredit the media, and the media became powerless against them. How were the campaign team able to do this, and why was this so effective?
I find it just shocking that they've been able to kind of marginalize all the mainstream and bring in people like Alex Jones and Breitbart as kind of the voice of this generation. I find it just horrifying that people are going there.
Alex Jones is, of course, the famous conspiracy theorist.
Insane conspiracy theorist, like far right wing, and really frightening. I mean, the clips that you see of him are are pretty hilarious, actually, because he's just completely rabid and crazy.
But surely that would
describe
Trump.
But he's part of this. Again, it's this disruptive presence. It's trying to shake the system up and create a smaller government and let people do what they want. And it's not really the Republican agenda, but they're using the Republican Party to do it. And
that is a very interesting point. And yeah. Zach, I want to get your thoughts on this sort of fake news era that we're in and post-truth era.
Yeah, I mean, it's very worrying, the clip with Roger Stones where he says the NBC is the CNN, actually, they're marginalised now, the Breitbart, and the more alt-right communications. It might be a slight exaggeration, but of becoming the more mainstream news source. It's something the author Tariq Ali called about the extreme centre. It's coming into the mainstream, which is very, very concerning, because this has a ripple effect, actually. It gives a confidence to the far right. Some of the appalling attacks we saw after the Trump presidency, because the platform given to the prominent far right blogs such as Breitbart is very concerning.
And how are left-wing groups trying to combat this?
I think what was very interesting over here, I know there's a, I forget the name of the blog in the States, but certainly over here you saw the election of Jeremy Corbyn, that social media was absolutely instrumental in that. The work of Momentum were combating the government's austerity agenda and helping to push some of Corbyn's policies forward, and it had a bigger impact in getting to young people in the general election.
So there's still some hope, I see. And I think, going back to the documentary, I think one of the funniest lines that Roger Stone says is that politics is show business for ugly people. But on a serious note, I mean, is this what politics has been reduced to now, Rich? I mean, is this merely a freak show, a circus, and not serving the best interests of the people anymore?
Well, you kind of hope that this will snap people out of it. It's like the fact that Donald Trump was elected president should make everybody stop and say, wait a minute, something's horribly wrong here. You know, the fact that Britain voted for Brexit made Britain stop. And then the next election, everybody kind of hesitated and thought, wait a minute. And the vote shifted quite dramatically because people spoke up and spoke the truth, which hadn't been spoken up during the campaign originally. Mm-hmm. And I'm hoping that that's what we see in America. I'm hoping that the people who just didn't speak up during the election last year will come out at the next one and kind of make the truth known and get because I think the truth has to win out in the end. Mm-hmm. It's too depressing to think that these people are going
to
win.
And I'd love to end it on that note, actually. Thank you, Richard, and thank you, Zach, for your time. And that's it for this episode of Doc Review. Thank you to both my guests and to you. I've been Camila Shambayati.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. We'll be right back.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.